Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. So far this year, our election administration has been turned upside down by the COVID-19 pandemic. 16 presidential primary contests were postponed, and Wisconsin held an election amidst the pandemic that likely saw depressed turnout. There were polling location closures, long lines, and reports of voters not receiving the mail ballots they requested. This all raises the question of how we're preparing for the presidential election this fall, in case there are still concerns about the spread of the virus from social gatherings. So today, we're going to take a look at that question from two perspectives. First, how the United States has dealt with administering elections during times of crisis in the past. And then second, what kinds of measures states and the federal government can be taking to ensure the integrity of this fall's vote. So later in this episode, I'm going to speak with Wendy Weiser of the Brennan Center about the plan that they've proposed. But first, here with me is 538 elections analyst Jeffrey Skelly to talk about American elections during historical crises. Hey, Jeff, thanks for being with me.
Hey, thanks for having me, Galen.
Okay, so first off, let's start with a really basic question, Jeff. Has the American presidential election ever been postponed, and is it even possible?
It has never really been postponed. Congress, back in 1845, actually passed a law setting the date of the election, which is why we have it in November. And basically, that law has never been changed. So it would take a congressional action to move the date of the presidential contest. And, you know, that's difficult to imagine happening. Obviously, it would be a really partisan conversation, I'm sure. I mean, everything's partisan to some extent these days, but as you get closer and closer to it, I think the idea of delaying it, that would just really be an unprecedented situation.
And no matter what, our inauguration date is in the Constitution. So it would have to happen before January 20th, presumably.
Right. And that's another challenge. It's like, well, if you move it back, does that affect other things? It's just really hard to imagine there being a consensus on that to actually move the date. I think, you know, there'd be conversations about, well, why can't we try to push toward all mail or nearly all mail voting in most states or all states? You know, those are the sorts of conversations I think people will be having more so than moving the election back.
We have already seen more than a dozen presidential primaries be postponed. Is that unprecedented?
Well, it's not unprecedented for a primary to be moved for some reason. And even in a disaster situation, it actually happened with New York City. Well, New York State had a primary in 2001 that happened to be scheduled for September 11th. Obviously, it was not easy to keep voting that day. So the governor basically declared an emergency and postponed the primary. And so it actually happened a couple weeks later. But that's obviously a particularly extreme case where something happened the very day of the primary. In terms of presidential primaries being postponed for some sort of, you know, act of God kind of cataclysm thing, that hasn't happened. It's one thing to postpone it because of lawsuits or court orders, because of something about the election administration or something related to the ballot, but it's different. You know, there hasn't been anything like this before.
I want to dig deeper back into American history and look at some of those elections. But first, let's address the election that just happened in Wisconsin during the heat of this crisis. So what impact did it have on the administration and then on the eventual results?
I think the question of election administration is a little easier to answer than just how it affected the results, though we can say some things about turnout. We know that the election being carried out created this huge surge in desire for absentee ballots. And so that was tough for local election administration officials to process requests and to, you know, send them back out. There are many thousands of voters who did not receive their absentee ballot that they applied for. And there are probably plenty who sent them in but didn't get them in time, because the U.S. Supreme Court basically required that they be postmarked by the day of the election. And so if you got your ballot late and tried to send it in late, you know, if it was postmarked after April 7th, which was the official election date, it wouldn't count. And so there's going to be some debate about that. There's already legal wrangling going on about the result. And in terms of the impact What we can say is that turnout was down from the 2016 presidential primary, but it is important to remember that only one side had a competitive or even somewhat competitive presidential contest going on. And so the Democratic race was the only one of interest. So if you look at the turnout for Democrats in 2016, it was a little over a million voters. And this time around, it looks like it was just a bit more than 900,000. So it was down as a share of the voting eligible population. It was down a couple points. That's actually not as bad as you might have thought, all things considered.
But I'm curious because it seemed like there has been some assumption amongst Republicans that high levels of mail voting would disadvantage them. And Republicans in Wisconsin didn't want to see a mail ballot sent to every registered voter in Wisconsin. Can we ultimately say who was advantaged by the fact that they didn't do that, right? There wasn't a ballot sent to every eligible voter, because it looks like the liberal candidate for the state Supreme Court ended up doing better than anybody expected, despite the fact that Democrats were saying Republicans had set up this election to advantage themselves.
Well, I think my response to that is that there was a recent study actually that was just released in reaction to all this talk about, you know, what's the impact of mail-in balloting? Is there some partisan gain? And really the evidence was there's not really much evidence at all that one side uniformly benefits from mail-in balloting. There is some evidence that it increases turnout marginally, but not that it particularly helps one party or the other. And then think about the Wisconsin case. You know, I think the complication here is that there weren't two competitive presidential primaries, because if that had been the case, Republican turnout would have been a lot higher. And so maybe what should have happened here is that people should have realized that Democrats had a baseline advantage in the state Supreme Court race, even with the trouble of getting people to the polls. But I think there was real concern that the sort of downtick in turnout that you saw in Milwaukee had 40,000 fewer votes in the Democratic primary in 2020 than it did in 2016. And you saw something that was went from 180 some odd polling places to five, which was outrageous. So clearly that had an impact there. But for the Democrats and the liberal state Supreme Court candidate, the fact is that it didn't fall that much everywhere else necessarily. But the Democratic presidential primary is a complication here in terms of trying to figure out, did one side really benefit that much, or was one side hurt a lot? Because on face value, Milwaukee losing 40 or having 40,000 fewer votes would seemingly be very bad for the Democrats, considering it's one of the most Democratic parts of the state. However, the state Supreme Court justice ended up winning handily, and maybe that just has a lot to do with the fact that you had 900,000 some odd people vote in the Democratic presidential primary and 600,000 some odd people vote in the Republican presidential primary. And that just that fundamental difference in turnout because one had a competitive presidential primary was very important.
All right, let's look a little further back into our history for some examples of how we've gone about holding elections during periods of crisis. You mentioned 9/11. What other kinds of crises have our elections survived?
Well, I think a good sign is that we managed to hold a presidential election during the midst of the Civil War in 1864. And actually, we also held the midterm election, which wasn't necessarily all on the same date back in the day, but around 1862, there were the midterm elections as well. So we've managed to do that even when the country was, you know, torn apart. So that's reassuring to some extent.
I mean, how did that happen? How do you administer an election during a civil war?
Well, you have people go to the polls anyway. I mean, you didn't have, you know, a disease impacting the ability of people to go to the polls who weren't serving. And importantly, during the conflict, many states really made a push to enable soldiers to vote. So you had some really early forms of absentee balloting going on. In some cases, election officials from states would travel to where large groups of soldiers from their state were located and do the balloting there and then bring the votes back. It sounds kind of nuts, but that was a really early form of absentee voting. Now, there was some partisan intrigue in all this because there was a belief that soldiers were more likely to vote for the GOP, the Republican Party, And so there was Republicans controlled a fair number of state governments. They made a push to pass laws permitting this sort of practice. And it was also a very different time. I mean, the ballots, for instance, were produced by the parties, not the state. So there's some weirdness there that's not really at all relevant to our conversations today. But it does show sort of how, okay, we're in the midst of this crisis. We need to figure out a way to make it easier for soldiers to vote because they are particularly hampered by being out in the field. So let's figure out the best way to do this. And we've seen that in other crises as well, which I'm happy to go into.
Yeah, so Civil War, probably the most relevant experience the country has had would have been the Spanish flu in the 19-teens. What did we do? And also, how did it end up affecting the results of the election?
Right. So 1918, the midterm election, Woodrow Wilson's second midterm as president, we're in the midst of World War One. In fact, World War One is actually about to end, but no one knows that going into Election Day right then and there, that it's going to end a little over a week after the election. What you have is kind of an interesting situation where in the Civil War, you saw actions to try to help soldiers vote. But this time around, instead of the soldiers being, you know, in the continental United States, they are overseas. And you have a couple million men, and only men could really vote at this point. I mean, that wasn't true in every state, but in most states, only men could vote in the presidential election or any sort of federal election. And you had a couple million men overseas, mostly in France. And so that made it more difficult to get them ballots, to put them in a position to be able to vote. So actually, not a lot was done to help them vote. And then on top of that, you have the influenza crisis, which ends up killing hundreds of thousands of people died because of the Spanish flu in the United States. And it happened to actually really ratchet up, really get going in the fall of 1918. And in some parts of the country, particularly the West, it was really peaking in its severity around Election Day. So you would think that that affected turnout, and overall turnout in the election among the voting eligible population was about 40%, which was well down from the 1910 and 1914 midterm elections, where a little over 50% participated in those. So the war obviously played a big role there. You have a couple million potentially eligible voters overseas. But at the same time, you had, and I talked to some experts about this, you had photos of people lining up in San Francisco to vote wearing masks. You know, what kind of atmosphere is that for encouraging people to go out to vote? So undoubtedly it affected things to some extent. There was a report, I think, in the LA Times right around then that said that roughly 40,000, they estimated 40,000 people didn't vote in San Francisco because of the influenza panic. And there wasn't really that much done about it. And that's an interesting question because people actually went and voted despite fears about the disease. It was also a different time in terms of you're in the middle of a war. There's a lot of patriotic fervor, a lot of calls about doing your duty. There was like an LA Times headline that talked about like every Californian will do their duty and go to the polls. So I think that played a role in sort of there not being much conversation about, oh, should we postpone the election? Should we even be doing this right now with a public health crisis? Instead, people went and voted. Now, turnout was down, but people still voted.
Does it seem at all that the final result was affected by voting patterns that changed because of either the influenza or World War One?
You know, this is a really interesting question. There isn't really any evidence that I've seen about how it might have affected the result, at least in a really empirical, digging into the data way. But there were observers at the time, including the chairman of the Republican National Committee, who felt that there were some results in a couple states. There was a quote mentioned in an article I read talking about Kentucky and Indiana, that in some Republican-leaning areas, the party didn't do as well as you would have normally expected. And so maybe Republican gains should have been even larger. It's important to understand that this was the second midterm for Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, and his party did very poorly in the 1918 midterm. So Republicans took control of the House and the Senate in that election. But at least the RNC chairman was saying, well, our gains could have been even bigger. So maybe it did affect them to some extent, but it's hard to pin down.
I think probably the other major example we have of voting during a time of crisis would be World War II. You mentioned that not a lot was done to ensure that soldiers could vote during World War I. Did that change at all for the Second World War?
Yes. There was a push to make it easier for soldiers to vote. Now, in the 1942 midterm election, it didn't really have much of an impact. You have to understand that the complication here is that you have states that administer elections. So you have 50 different state apparatuses to deal with. In fact, at that point, I guess 48, because Alaska and Hawaii weren't states yet. But the point is, you have all these different states they need to administer by sending ballots overseas. But unlike in previous conflicts, the troops weren't really grouped together by state. I think it's important to understand that over time, our military moved from calling up troops that all came together in a state, and like a brigade would be made up entirely of soldiers from the same state or same like local community even, to a system where a platoon or brigade, whatever, has people from all over. So how do you make it easy to get ballots from, if you've got five guys from New York, six from Alabama, four from Tennessee, how do you make it easy for them to get the ballot from their state, their respective state, when they're all over the place and all mixed up, state by state? So there was a push to get federal ballots, at least, so for congressional office, to those voters, but it largely failed in 1942. It didn't work really well at all. But in 1944, they came back and tried to make it even easier. And actually, I think estimates something about 2.5, close to 3 million soldiers did vote in the 1944 presidential election. Now, in both 42 and 44, turnout was notably down from the previous midterm or presidential election. So, it's likely that the war impacted voting in terms of lowering turnout. But at least in the 1944 presidential election, there was more turnout because soldiers did manage to vote in large numbers. And in fact, because of the way the votes were separated out in some states, you could actually see that in New Jersey, Franklin Roosevelt actually carried the state because of the soldier vote over Thomas Dewey, his Republican opponent. So that actually, the votes from overseas actually made the difference for FDR.
So these kinds of provisions for dealing with crises can make the difference in a presidential election, essentially.
To be clear, FDR would have won the election without New Jersey, but if you're thinking if it's a closer election and the soldier vote ends up making the difference, then yeah, I mean, definitely.
Yeah. So I think the last big example, you wrote a piece looking at these historical examples. The last one you mentioned was Hurricane Sandy, which happened right before, a week and a half before the presidential election in 2012. It's interesting. I was actually in New York. My polling place was flooded. It was the basement of a church. And so they moved our polling place to allow people to, continue to vote. What kinds of other measures were taken to ensure that the election could continue in the tri-state area and along the East Coast where Sandy impacted states the hardest?
Right. So I think the view is that New York and New Jersey suffered the most because of Sandy. And in New Jersey, actually, you had basically anyone who was displaced by the storm. The government in New Jersey said, okay, you count as an overseas voter now. Which opened up means for them to get absentee ballot applications or even an absentee ballot to their election administrator in a different way. They could email it or fax it. It basically just made it easier for them to get that information to the election administrator because they were basically put under this categorization. In New York, you saw the shifting of polling places. I mean, you had that in New Jersey too. The shifting, even in some cases, people had to vote in tents. Obviously, because it happened so soon, right before the election, that was a real challenge for trying to make these real quick changes to enable people to participate in the election. And you did see in New Jersey, I think particularly, or at least the evidence I found, in some cases, some counties were sort of overwhelmed by the number of people sending in absentee ballot information. They just couldn't handle it all because it was much larger than the normal amount they were used to dealing with. And obviously some people in those places who may have been dealing with election administration were also personally affected. So it was a bit haphazard.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was no question who would win New York and New Jersey in the 2012 presidential election. But was there any indication that the overall turnout was impacted by the storm?
Yeah, there was at least one study I found that showed that areas where the storm surge was particularly high, turnout in those places was definitely down compared to the rest of the state. And in terms of thinking about the potential impact on the outcome, now, as you point out, New York and New Jersey, blue states, they weren't really expected to be competitive in any way. There was at least one study I found that suggested that Obama may have won Virginia, which he carried, I think, about 4 points, 3.5, something like that, in 2012, that he may have carried it in part because turnout was affected in the eastern part of the state in some places that were hit by Hurricane Sandy. Now, some of that was sort of a counterfactual investigation, but nonetheless, you know, and it wouldn't have changed the outcome overall, but it's fascinating to see.
And I mean, just this maybe doesn't necessarily affect who can vote or how they vote, but there was a lot of discussion at the time about whether or not there was a rally around the flag effect, whether President Obama going to New Jersey and having the Republican governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, giving him like a big hug on the tarmac, and whether that decreased partisan sentiment and ended up helping Obama win re-election, which, you know, is not about the election administration, but about how crises can affect elections. I don't know if you have any take on whether or not there was a significant enough rally around the flag effect that it actually did impact the election.
You know, I didn't find anything that specifically talked about that, but you're absolutely right that could potentially shift conversation and make people view the president in a more positive light, even if they didn't approve of him previously. And we're seeing President Trump actually maybe benefit from that a little bit too. Our colleague Nathaniel Rakich has written about that. So, that definitely could have played some role, though I do wonder if it was more localized than, say, what we're going through right now in terms of areas that were hit versus areas that weren't, whereas everyone, to some extent, is dealing with this. Obviously, some places have been hit harder than others by the coronavirus, but to some extent, everyone is concerned about this.
Yeah. All right. Well, Jeffrey, thank you so much for giving us some insight into the history of the U.S. dealing with administering elections during times of crisis. It's been really interesting to hear. And, you know, it kind of sets the stakes for this fall in terms of whether or not we can come up with good solutions to voting during a pandemic, because when you don't come up with those mitigating strategies, it does affect who can vote and how. So thank you, Jeff.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's move on and talk about some of those possible strategies to mitigate the challenges that COVID-19 could pose to voting this fall. So in its recent $2.2 trillion bill, Congress designated $400 million to help states administer elections this fall in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. According to the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law, it could cost up to $2 billion to cover the measures they say would ensure the integrity of the vote. So the Brennan Center put out a report covering exactly what measures they think should be taken to protect the election. And here with me to discuss is one of the authors, Wendy Weiser. She's the vice president and director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center and is also an author of the report, How to Protect the 2020 Vote from the Coronavirus. Hi, Wendy. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So do you think that right now we are on a trajectory for there to be major complications with the 2020 vote because of the coronavirus?
Absolutely. There's going to be a huge challenge this year to have safe and fair elections. And it's going to be a massive national project to get the country ready for November. And if we don't actually get on it right now, we can risk massive meltdowns and disruptions in November that could threaten the vote for every American and the perceived fairness and legitimacy of the election.
Let's get into the details off the bat. What are some of those complications that you see?
Right now, we are facing the unprecedented threat of a pandemic that is requiring massive social distancing, which is going to make it very difficult and for many people impossible to show up at polling places, to go to government offices where they can register to vote, for election workers to congregate, to do the range of tasks that have to be done, both to prepare for and to count the votes this November. In order to handle this big challenge, we need to dramatically reimagine and retrofit our election infrastructure to ensure that everybody can vote. And first and foremost, we're going to need to see a massive increase in the use of mail voting. We've seen a huge increase in the use of voting by mail over the course of the past number of years across the country. Many people don't know this, but 30% of Americans are casting their ballots by mail even before this pandemic. But we're going to see that number shoot up as many people are going to be unable or unwilling to go to their polling places. We're also going to need to dramatically reconfigure how we run our polling places to make sure that they are safe and healthy, to make sure that the election period is spread out over a longer period of time, and to make sure that the physical space is spread out and sanitized so that it's healthy both for the voters and for the election workers. Those are just the kind of two of the big changes that need to be made, but there are a range of other changes. This all takes a lot of infrastructure, a lot of planning, some changes also to our laws. And if we don't get on it now, we won't be ready by November. But if we do get on it, we do have enough time to make these changes. This is a challenge that we actually can meet, but we need to get on it.
I want to dig into voting by mail. There are some states that do a lot of voting by mail, and voters there may be very familiar with it, and they have plans in place to make sure that it runs smoothly. But for states that don't, it can be a pretty complicated process, and there are challenges that voting by mail poses that you don't have when people are showing up at the specific polling place. So can you run through with me some of the challenges you see of voting by mail on a mass scale in November?
I think that there are going to be no doubt significant challenges in every state, and especially in the states that don't see a majority of their votes coming in by mail. Currently, we only have 5 states that conduct primarily all-mail elections. They still have ways that people can vote in person, but that's their primary way of voting. There are other states, and in fact, in most of the country, you can get a mail ballot without any excuse if you want one. It's called no-fault absentee voting, but there are 16 states which don't even offer that as an option regularly. But even in the places that do have that, the use of mail voting is still quite small. So they are going to see a dramatic surge for the use of mail balloting. So that's going to lead to a huge range of pressures and strains on the election system. The very first, there might not be, if we don't plan for it, enough mail ballots and mail ballot envelopes to send to people. Election officials might not have enough equipment, like the scanning equipment, like the extracting equipment to remove ballots from their envelopes, to be able to process and count those ballots and to do so on time. And then there's a whole range of challenges in between. There are processes that need to be developed to make sure that everybody's ballot counts, to make sure that we can adequately track those ballots. There need to be ballot tracking numbers to ensure that ballots aren't thrown out. One thing that we've seen in across the country is the counting rates are really vary state by state. In some states, there's a very high rejection rate of absentee ballots because they don't have best practices in place to match people's signatures, to be able to ensure that every ballot counts, to notify people if they have a problem with the ballot and get them to correct it on time. All of this is going to need to be put in place before November in order to be prepared for this. And I will say that the problems are even more than what needs to be prepared. We have to look at supply chain problems as well. Right now, there are only 4 printing companies that are certified to print ballots across the country. They can, you know, subcontract other printing companies. Election offices will need to be able to develop those capacities themselves as they can. We're going to need to see that capacity beefed up before November. The capacity for building the equipment needed to count and process those ballots will need to be beefed up. The storage facilities to hold those mail ballots that come in, we're going to need to be set aside and procured now. Just to give a couple of examples of, you know, what a massive public project this is to just, even within this, using the same rules to shift so dramatically the way in which Americans are voting this year.
Yeah, so I think you've already seen this a little bit when the House proposed more measures to address the fall elections. You heard Republicans characterizing some of those measures as promoting ballot harvesting. This issue of election fraud or voter fraud is a very tricky one to address appropriately because, for example, in-person voter fraud almost never happens in this country. But I was reading a piece that Rick Hassan wrote, a law professor at UC Irvine, recently that does address some of the challenges that vote by mail poses. And we did, in fact, see in 2018 that there was election fraud committed in North Carolina's 9th congressional district using the vote by mail process, essentially collecting ballots from people who had received ballots by mail, filling them out. This was the Republican side in this case, filling them out and skewing the election as a result. And that election had to be redone. So what kinds of steps can we take to make sure that whatever opportunities voting by mail does present for people who would try to undermine our elections, that they don't have the opportunity to do that?
So that's a really important question. And while it is true that there are more reported instances of voting fraud or really election fraud, it's not fraud by individual voters, but by institutional actors using absentee or mail ballots than there are in in-person voting systems, it's important to put that in context. The numbers are still infinitesimally small. And the North Carolina congressional election that you're talking about was so notable in part because it was so rare. As we note, there are 5 states that conduct their elections primarily by mail, and they have never had a scandal of this sort. So this is still a very rare problem. And one of the lessons of North Carolina is that, you know, there are systems already in place to be able to track and catch these systems. And I'd say that that's one thing that over time, as the country has moved towards more mail balloting, we've gotten better and the jurists and election officials have gotten better at protecting against fraud. And one great technology is barcoding our ballots. Every absentee or mail ballot that gets sent has a barcode, so you can actually track it down. If you don't receive it, if somebody stole it out of your mailbox, they can identify that particular ballot and remove it. It's easier to track what happened with that ballot when it comes in because of that. We've developed now secure Dropbox technologies. And I think that that's also important. And in places like Colorado, where they put Dropboxes outside of government offices, they've also equipped those boxes with cameras to be able to detect those kind of wrongdoers. That said, the kind of fraud that we saw in North Carolina is really difficult, if not impossible, to do on a much larger scale because it required individuals to go around to people's mailboxes. And at a time of social distancing, this will be very noticeable and very hard to do at a very large scale nationally. But we really have seen, like a real improvement in, you know, fraud prevention technologies and techniques by election officials. And the result is this is really anomalous.
Yeah. So I think there are 2 challenges here, right? One is the actual problem, which is potential fraud that you've discussed can be mitigated in certain ways. The other is for bad faith actors in American politics, in the media, to try to undermine the election or the results of the election by asking questions about, was there fraud? For example, with mail-in voting, oftentimes it takes a really long time to count all the ballots. And so the election night result may look very different from the result 2 weeks later when all of the ballots have been counted. And so suggestions of fraud, questioning the process because of how long it may take to count the ballots, how do you preemptively try to deal with the challenges that that poses for holding an election that both the winning and losing side trust the end result?
You know, even before the pandemic hit the United States, this was a real threat facing the 2020 election. We've seen an increase of the use of that tactic of sort of trying to undermine the legitimacy of elections through false claims of voter fraud. The president has been one of the greatest proponents and users of that tactic, and even tried to undermine the results of the election that he won in 2016 by claiming that there were widespread voter fraud that accounted for his loss of the popular vote. So this was certainly a big threat going into 2020, even before the coronavirus. And I think that the antidote to that is correct information. Also, you know, we should be setting expectations now. Mail ballots take longer to count and process than non-mail ballots. We already saw allegations of misconduct in Kentucky and in California when it took longer to get the results. That is something that we should be anticipating and preparing Americans for. It is going to take longer to get your election day results now. And so if it happens, it's not the result of any shenanigans. That's just the result of election officials going and trying to get the answer right. And if people expect that, they're less likely to receive it as evidence of shenanigans. But I will say on the other side, what I'm even equally worried about isn't just the kind of false claims of voter fraud being drummed up to, you know, justify undermining faith in our electoral system and in the results of the election. It's also efforts to try to goad public officials into what I think might be a dereliction of their duty to actually ensure that the election works for every American. And that's something that really raised concerns with President Trump's interview on Fox News, where he seemed to suggest that measures that will increase access to voting might be not desirable because they undermine electoral prospects for Republicans. I think that was a rather shocking thing to say, and really not only inappropriate, but sounds like an invitation to public officials at the both in our Congress and at the state level to undermine their patriotic duties and their legal duties to make the system work for everybody.
So maybe it's worth asking this bluntly. I mean, do you think that given the politics surrounding this, that the measures that you propose in your report on how to plan for the fall election, given the coronavirus pandemic, do you think they're unlikely to be adopted?
No, actually, I think that many of them are likely to be adopted. And I think in most of the country, we're going to see many, if not most, of these measures adopted. You know, the question is, will it happen everywhere? And will it happen quickly enough? By and large, I've seen election officials from both political parties rallying, trying to get financial support from both the Congress and from their state legislatures. You know, and by and large, we're going to see significant movement towards adjusting the election infrastructure to make it healthy. The real question and the real concern is that going to include everybody? And are there going to be shenanigans where the system's going to be set up that not everybody can access it? So if we, you know, for example, our voter registration system, most of the voter registrations happen when people go to government offices. Those offices are closed. Another significant chunk of voter registration is when people meet with civic groups or volunteer activists at the malls, at fairs. They're not out and about registering. coverage at signing up voters. Are we going to have accessible registration services online everywhere? There are still 10 states that don't have that available. And in the places where it is online, most of them don't currently allow for online registration for people that don't have a DMV ID. And that's going to shut out a huge portion of the population unless we find some other mechanism to make sure that they can register and vote either on the internet, for the people with a digital divide, by phone, through other mechanisms where offices are shuttered. That's going to be a significant mar on the election. You know, similarly, in places that have mail voting, where there are significant portions of the population that do not or cannot access mail ballots, like in Native American reservations where they don't have residential addresses and multiple families share a P.O. box, or where people have poor mail service and it's lost. Are there going to be alternative means for those voters to be able to show up in person at a polling location or somewhere else in order to vote? Are we going to have processes for where we throw out ballots or ballot applications for people who have some technical defect that can't be remedied in the time of a coronavirus, but they're eligible voters? And I think that's where the real work and concerns are going to have to be after we get election officials the resources they need to make the big shifts that we need to make, or else the election won't even happen properly.
You've mentioned that some states do take some measures, others don't. Most elections officials in states are getting on board. What are the states that you're most concerned about at this point?
There are states right now that are struggling with their primaries, and I'm concerned that the problems that we are seeing in places like Wisconsin, in Georgia, in Ohio, are not going to be resolved quickly enough. And that's going to make it harder for people to come together to solve the problems across some partisan lines before November. And so some of those stresses are starting to show.
So we've been mostly talking about voting by mail, but of course, voting in person is still going to be a part of this election. So what kind of precautions should states be planning for in order to make sure that people who do want to vote in person can do so safely?
Yeah, and it's not just the voters that we need to protect, it's also the election workers as well. I think that, you know, it is critical that polling places still be available. In any system of mail voting, there are gaps, there are problems, there are people who don't get their ballots, there are people who experience other problems in accessing the mail balloting system, and if there isn't a polling place for them to go to, they won't have an option to vote. So that is a critical fail-safe for any mail voting system, and especially for people who can't access mail ballots. Our polling places are, you know, have been, unfortunately, in many parts of the country, characterized by crowded conditions and extremely long lines. And this is not going to be acceptable, or it's never acceptable at any time, but now it's going to be especially a public health risk. And so we're going to need to see a range of changes in order to make sure that our polling place elections have adequate social distancing and adequate sanitary conditions. So if we just sort of start with spreading out voting, we're going to need to have voting over a longer period of time. In places that don't have extended early voting periods, we'll need to see that. In places that have that, we're going to need to see that time expand. Polling locations will need to be large enough, and the polling stations, both the voting stations and the stations for checking in, are going to need to be spread out so people have the adequate distancing. They're going to need to be sanitized. There's going to be need to be a lot of sanitary equipment for poll workers. You know, this should be thought of as essential work. This should be like our groceries. Our democracy should be an essential work that is done. But like all our other essential workers, they need to be able to do it safely and consistent with their own health. And it needs to be safe for voters who show up as well.
Considering how complex this all is, and how varying all of the rules for voting are state by state, is there anything that Congress can do on a federal level to try to get some of these practices more in sync with making sure that the election can go forward? Besides the funding, of course.
Absolutely. I mean, frankly, even not in the face of a pandemic, I strongly believe that Congress should be setting minimum baseline rules for federal elections across the country to ensure that every eligible American has the same minimal level of access across the country. And so this is something that absolutely ought to happen in any modern democracy. And in this case, I think that Congress should be setting some basic rules for this year to ensure that every eligible American has access to a mail ballot if they want one, to make sure that they also have access to safe and healthy polling places, to make sure that they have access to voter registration. There also needs to be some work in extending deadlines to make sure that election officials have enough time to receive all these ballots and count all these ballots in time to be certified. That's another critical step that Congress can take. So these are all of the kind of baseline requirements that are needed everywhere in the country. And in the places that already have some of these in place, Congress setting those rules won't change that. You know, realistically, at this point, I'm anticipating that more of this is going to be done at the state by state level. But, you know, if we did have a functioning Congress right now, this would be thought to be a top, you know, national emergency priority to set down some basic rules to ensure that our election runs smoothly and in a healthful way for every single American. This is the cornerstone of our political system, of our democracy, one of the, you know, things that make America great, and we need to make sure that it is it functions well and is great.
Final question here. You talked about setting expectations in advance for a more complicated election day in terms of counting ballots and tallying everything up than we've had in past years. What role is there for the media? What kind of messages should we be giving people, you know, maybe as far out as now, or at least in the months in the run-up to actual election day? Like, should we just tell people you're not going to get results on election day, period? You'll get them within a week of election day? Like, how should we set expectations?
I think that's absolutely right. I think that it is highly likely that we're not going to see results on election day this year. And I think we should be setting those expectations now. I think that the obligation of the media probably extends well beyond that. It extends towards ensuring that people don't, you know, foment false fears of or claims of fraud or misconduct where it's not warranted to try to undermine the election. It will be super important amidst all of the confusion and fear that people already have to be a source of continuous, accurate information about what's going on in the election process. We were already heading into 2020 with a high threat of disinformation, not only from our own domestic actors, but as we've been hearing from our intelligence agencies, you know, that Russia and other foreign adversaries have been stepping up their disinformation and also efforts at electoral manipulation programs. And with that, it will be even more important with all of the changes that are going on now to ensure that people have a steady stream of accurate information, because they will be much more vulnerable to and susceptible to misinformation. It will be much harder to know what is true.
Yeah, especially now I'm thinking as you're saying this, if we're going to be changing how, potentially where, when people vote, making sure that voters actually know what all of those changed rules are, because when people are expecting that there will be changes, they could hear the wrong changes. They could hear, you know, you go on social media, you see like okay, like you're supposed to vote this way or you're not supposed to vote or blah, 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 blah. Making sure that people actually have the correct information about when and where they should be voting.
Yes. And I will say that even in 2016, that was one of the tactics of disinformation, the vote suppression tactics that were used was giving people wrong information about the voting process, telling them to text their votes or do other things which might sound more realistic this year, but it will not be true. And I think that that will be really important to counter and to ensure that people repeatedly hear the correct information about the voting process and know what to expect from their election officials. I will say that this is, you know, running elections is somewhat of a thankless job. People only notice you when things go wrong. And they're upset about it. When things go well, people, there's not really much of an upside in terms of public perception. And I think now more than ever, you know, we need to support our election workers, ensure that they have the resources and the safety equipment that they need. Our democracy depends on them, as it always has, but even more so now. And I think having some appreciation of the work that they are doing and that they're going to have to do is going to be really important. And I will say they're also going to need a lot more support. We're already seeing jurisdictions facing significant shortages of poll workers and election workers. They're going to need to really dramatically increase their workforce, both volunteer and paid workforces, and leading up to the election. And that's something that we can all support as well and be part of that solution.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there for now. Maybe we'll check back in as this progresses, we get closer to Election Day. But thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Wendy Weiser directs the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center and is an author of the report, How to Protect the 2020 Vote from the Coronavirus. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. You can also find us on YouTube. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.